Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program today, how US strikes are redrawing the Middle East map, the Iran war's ripple through the global economy, why climate change is now a boardroom priority, and how blessers are preying on South Africa's youth. It's Monday, the 23rd of June. The Middle East is once again on a knife edge, and this time the United States has stepped directly into the fray as tensions between Israel and Iran escalate. There are now confirmed reports that U.S. forces have carried out limited strikes on Iranian nuclear infrastructure. My question, is this tactical containment or the start of something far more dangerous? And what, if anything, is the end game for President Trump as he navigates an increasingly volatile global landscape, one that could spiral into a wider war? Joining me now is veteran international relations commentator, Professor John Stremlaw. John, a very warm welcome. And maybe the first question, in your opinion, has the U.S. crossed a red line by directly entering the Israel-Iran conflict, or do you see this as something that was inevitable?
Well, that's an easy question, Jeremy. The more difficult questions were the ones that you signaled in your intro. We don't know where this is going. It is disturbing to me because four presidents before Donald Trump have looked hard at this issue and concluded that they didn't really know whether Iran was close to developing a bomb. And indeed, Trump's own intelligence chief, appearing before Congress, said she didn't know whether or not the likelihood of a bomb was anywhere nearer or farther away, because the intelligence is funny business, but it's an iffy business. And so that it is unclear how close they were to a bomb. However, now that Donald Trump has taken this divisive action, you have 40,000 American troops in the region that are vulnerable. And so this could escalate quite seriously.
John, what would it take to escalate it?
Well, it would take, it was not much. It would take missiles and directed at U.S. bases and ships. And it could take the cyber stuff. There's lots of options, as we've learned to our peril since 9/11, that can be taken to rectify a situation. The Iranians took the U.S. hostages back in 79, and that's what set off this sequence of events. But Ali Khamenei, the supreme leader, is 86. 7 years older than Donald Trump. And these guys are not going to live forever. And so how strong this dictator in Iran is for the Iranian people to decide and for the resilience of that regime. But it's been very resilient so far. And I expect that they will take some action. But Donald Trump is in office until, for reasons I can't explain, anyway, the American people voted him in until 2028. And so it is a very difficult situation to understand, but it's explosive.
John, what we also don't have clarity on whether this is an act of deterrence or a step towards regime change in Iran. It seems that Washington itself is confused about the objective, and we've had mixed messages coming out from various leaders in various portfolios.
Well, the only portfolio that matters is Donald Trump, and he's an unpredictable, I've never seen a president like him. And he gambles and loses often, then protests the loss, as in 2020. But he is the man in charge, and he decided, and the ruse of saying he was going to wait 2 weeks was only a ruse. He was determined that he would take this stand now in support of the Israelis, but he doesn't cite the intelligence that he acted on. And Bibi Netanyahu does say, and he's a tribalist for sure, a Zionist, and he wants the Palestinians out of Israel. That's context of all this, the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. And he saw Iran as a threat to Israel, Zionism, and therefore had taken steps to eliminate that threat. But these are complicated issues. And again, I say that four presidents have looked at it and decided that it was worth negotiating with Iran. And there was a 2015 agreement among the five powers of the Security Council, plus Germany, to patrol the development of the nuclear capacity and keep it peaceful. And so here we are. I mean, Trump has acted impulsively and gambled with the lives of lots of innocent people. But that's not new to South Africans, because they've suffered from the consequences of his preemptive work in killing off AID. Mm.
John, let's reference South Africa then. What does it mean for this country, in your opinion, both economically and diplomatically, given our historic ties to the non-aligned movement and obviously our dependence on oil imports?
Well, the dependence on oil imports is a concern. It could be a spike in prices, which would certainly not benefit South Africa and would hurt this fragile economy. And I don't want to diminish the economic stakes that Cyril Ramaphosa manfully went ahead and defended in that confrontation with Trump, and did so very effectively. He was the only adult in the room. But it is difficult to see how South Africa can deal with Donald Trump. His executive order of February 17th was so ignorant of the realities in South Africa, the hard realities, and his closing down of AID was so cruel to the 5.4 million HIV sufferers in South Africa, that the damage has already been done. And I think that the South Africans would be smart to, as they are doing, to build cooperation among all of the members of the international community that don't like Donald Trump.
I'm going to leave it there with my thanks, Professor John Stremlaw. Thank you very much indeed.
Join the South African Guide Dog Association in the Give a Cane campaign, running from the 5th of May to the 18th of July. Help us provide 1,000 white canes to visually impaired people by donating just 50 Rand. Your donation goes towards white canes and training, which helps our clients stay in touch with the world around them. Want to do more? Host your own fundraiser, get your book club, social group, school involved, or encourage your community to donate just 50 Rand. Be a part of someone's journey to freedom. Visit www.guidedog.org.za for more information.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, tensions in the Middle East have flared dangerously, and the global economy is already starting to feel the heat. With the United States launching strikes on Iranian targets, markets have turned jittery. Understandably, oil prices are climbing and central banks already grappling with sticky inflation and policy uncertainty are being forced into even tighter corners. So what does this mean for global growth, for risk sentiment, and for a country like ours that sits on the receiving end of oil shocks and capital flight? With me now is Professor Adrian Saville, strategist, economist, to discuss what the unfolding conflict in Iran could mean for the global economic outlook. Adrian, always good to talk to you, and thank you. We should, I guess, be taking this conflict very seriously, but do you think it's a temporary market wobble right now, or are we starting to see, or could we see, a longer-term economic threat?
Jeremy, great to be with you. I always wish it was under better circumstances. This has all of the makings of something much bigger than a local flare. It's got all of the ingredients. If you look at the two sides of the field and the allegiances to those two sides. So, unfortunately, you know, I would say that unless this is contained quickly, effectively, it is likely to translate into something much bigger.
And part of that much bigger, Adrian, is oil prices. We're already seeing the commodity surging. Is there a breaking point where this actually begins to choke global growth momentum? Already there's talk, for instance, of blockading or cutting the Hormuz Straits.
That would be, you know, sort of all bets off if the Hormuz Straits is blocked or closed, and you're likely to see oil prices go even higher. There's ways that suppliers could work around that. Saudi Arabia has a substantial oil pipeline which would allow them to circumvent that, and that might provide relief. But that doesn't change the fact that what you would be injecting into the environment are chokes in the ability to get to market. You would be injecting a whole fresh dose of instability and uncertainty. We've seen a number of airlines cancel flights over the last couple of days, including to, you know, other neighboring but critical economic and financial centers. See, flights were canceled by two airlines to Dubai yesterday. And all of the markers, if we look at commodity prices, oil and gold, they are both telling us expect worse rather than better from here.
And Adrian, I think we in South Africa need to be very nervous. We import most of our oil, and there is going to be a likely impact on fuel prices, inflation, and that could even spill over into interest rate expectation.
Jeremy, you know, here I think that there is a perhaps a, you know, a small room for relief. There's a tiny bit of silver lining on this in that South African inflation has been extremely well contained, well managed. We're in very low single-digit inflation, and the prospect of seeing this translate into the historical double-digit type scenarios. I'm not saying that that's off the cards, but it's certainly that wouldn't be my reading of the lay of the land as things stand. All of that said, the weaker currency and the combination of high oil prices put into that weak currency, that's going to add some basis points to inflation. But at this stage, you know, I wouldn't call for alarm around that scenario as things stand.
And Adrian, what about institutional investors and how they are likely to respond? Is this kind of geopolitical instability something that triggers reallocation or even in South Africa's case, capital outflow?
I think that that's a great point. In times of uncertainty, you head to the things that you sort of know and trust most. Historically, that has always been U.S. dollar and U.S. treasuries. That's the place that you scramble for in times of uncertainty. And what's striking about the course of 2025 is that investors have shied away from dollar and dollar assets. They've gone and looked in other places. So I'm not sure that they will change their behavior. They'll still be looking for safe havens. But I do wonder whether they are going to display the historical affinity with the greenback and dollar-based assets. I suspect not. I suspect that they will be looking in other places. euro, Swiss franc, perhaps even Japanese yen.
Is there concern, Adrian, that central banks, who would understandably be nervous, might overcorrect by starting to tighten policy again just as demand is starting to slow?
They might overreact. If you look at the recent behavior of central banks globally, they've been very cautious. They haven't acted with the same sort of speed and vigor as we saw global financial crisis, COVID being two recent dramatic episodes. In the very recent past, last couple of years, they've been far more sort of cautious, conservative, deliberate. And so I would suspect that they are likely to continue with that habit behavior unless we see, you know, something spectacular erupt, full-scale war. Then I think you can anticipate central banks to go right onto the front foot and be very aggressive in their actions.
And just a final one, and maybe a little bit left field, but South Africa also resumes trade talks with the United States later this week, I think due to begin or rescheduled for Wednesday. Given the rapid change in the geopolitical paradigm, are all bets off the table now as far as Pretoria is concerned and any expectation that we might have had?
Yeah, you know, we've shown our allegiances in our foreign policy or foreign diplomacy, and that card is on the table. So it's quite hard to see, you know, as things lie this morning, that this is going to go well for South Africa. That's hard to see under this scenario.
I'm going to leave it there. Adrian Saville, thank you very much indeed. Always appreciate your time and your insight.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, climate change is no longer a distant threat. It is here and it's hitting the agricultural sector where it hurts. With crop losses mounting, food security at risk all the time, the focus is shifting from prediction, I think, to preparation. From broken supply chains to battered infrastructure, farmers are constantly facing a mounting financial risk, and the insurance industry is stepping up. So I want to talk now about how agribusiness can build some real resilience and why climate is suddenly a critical boardroom issue. In that respect, Harry Doyne-Ditmas is with me, speciality growth leader at Marsh Africa. Harry, a very warm welcome. Let's start with this, the term insurance protection gap. What does it mean in the context of South African agriculture right now?
Yeah, thanks very much. And really, the protection gap refers to the fact that despite the importance of the agri-sector, South Africa faces one of the largest protection gaps globally, with the level of climate-related losses predicted only to increase. The majority of commercial farmers remain underinsured or uninsured against climate-related risks such as drought, flood, fire and hail. And many smallholders and emerging farmers are excluded entirely from the insurance ecosystem, leaving them extremely vulnerable to crop failure and income loss. I mean, Marsh is working across this value chain to support the sector. One, with existing insurers who provide coverage for such risks, although pricing and coverage payouts timings have challenges for certain risks. And two, working with financiers to structure solutions that safeguard loans against climate-related losses. Three, developing and innovating solutions to provide alternative risk transfer mechanisms that make coverage more accessible and cost-effective. And then four, lastly, and most importantly, creating and driving partnerships between private, public, and multilateral institutions to solve the complex nature of these challenges. So the protection gap really refers to a whole host of issues across the value chain.
Harry, how does the South African agricultural sector find itself in this parlous position where that protection gap is so wide?
There are a number of reasons why it's so wide. I mean, the challenges, as I say, are complex, from financing to building resilience at a local level. And insurance alone cannot solve and absorb climate risk. A holistic resilience strategy is central to mitigating these climate risks, particularly in South Africa. So whether it's climate smart agri practices, early warning systems, infrastructure hardening, or diversified income strategies, all of these build a greater resilience, which effectively creates a better platform to structure solutions and partnerships to allow access to capital, to create certainty where there is increasingly uncertain climate-related losses. Mm.
Harry, in terms of food security then, how vulnerable would you say the sector is right now? How exposed are farmers?
The data is pretty conclusive in that the severity of loss is going to increase and the frequency of loss is going to increase. We need to innovate and develop better strategies to allow the continued access to capital, to allow farmers to access cost-effective insurance solutions that provide better protection against the downside risk. And the exposure is very real. So, you know, it's something that public institutions, private institutions need to collaborate and work hard to solve some of these problems.
Do you think that traditional insurance then is still fit for purpose in this world that we're speaking about, where there are large and frequent big climate events?
So Marsh advocates for broad access to financial adaptation tools to help continue and increase, again, the access to capital for the agri industry. And these include index-based or parametric insurance solutions that pay out automatically based on predetermined trigger thresholds. And that's something that's new to the SA market. It's currently under regulatory approvals. It differs from conventional insurance and has many benefits that we think could help the industry massively. Blended finance models and innovative financing structures to support uptake of coverage by smallholders is also something that is going to be crucial to developing resilience and adaptation, as well as credit-linked insurance products for lenders to the agri sector, helping them reduce the downside risk related to borrower insolvency driven by climate risk. So sharing this risk with insurers, again, will help the banks, financiers manage exposures whilst also providing greater volumes of capital.
And I guess that given the scale of the problem, speed is of the essence. So I would imagine it begs the question about whether South African regulators and policymakers are moving quick enough to support the kind of innovation that is needed in this space.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And there's a lot of work that the industry can do through various groups in order to outline the extent of the challenges, but also provide pragmatic and proactive steps in order to break down those barriers. But it requires group learning, which is challenging, particularly when the problem is very real and very costly. But the cost of not doing anything is far greater than the cost, maybe the increase in cost, and whether it's time, resource, and financially, of having a climate-ready structure that underpins your business or underpins your loans.
So let me pick you up on that phrase, climate-ready structure. You also say that climate risk is now a boardroom issue. So very quickly, what has changed to bring it to executive level, and perhaps far more importantly, within the boardroom itself, is this risk, is this threat being taken seriously enough?
Well, food production and agribusiness is key to the SA economy and growth of the economy. Food security globally is also a key agenda item and influencing government policy and strategy. So what we need to understand is that there are very real operational risks for SA companies operating in the agri sector, but there are huge reputational risks that boardrooms are having to think about in terms of their relationship with clients if they can't deliver. And so this is creating a lot of pressure to think strategically about how they are managing these risks, how they are planning on accessing additional pools of capital or additional solutions and tools and advisory services to help deal with these problems. And boards are also being called to show alignment with ESG principles. Disclosure for climate-related risks within their annual accounts or TCFD disclosures are also an important component of proving your readiness to understand these risks and take steps to mitigate them, again, to ensure that you have ready access to capital. And that's really the key. It's maintaining that flow of capital through times of elevated risk.
That's where I'm going to leave it. Harry Doyen-Dittmus, thank you very much indeed. Speciality Growth Leader at Marsh Africa. I appreciate your time. Thank you.
MoneyWeb at Midday for all your up-to-date stories.
As youth unemployment surges past 62% in this country, South Africa is facing a grim social consequence. A growing rise in intergenerational sexual relationships, often transactional in nature. I want to talk now to Nadia Munsami from the National Shelter Movement to discuss this urgent and uncomfortable reality. Nadia, a very warm welcome, and your new data shows over 82% of young women in poorer communities are engaged in these relationships. What are the main drivers beyond poverty? What are you noticing?
So the drivers are economic hardship, gender inequality, and social media trends. These are actually driving the blessy relationships.
And how are these arrangements, in your opinion, then affecting the mental health and maybe even the agency of young women? Are there particular signs that you're seeing in shelters that you are involved in?
Yes, most definitely. So it actually shows, they show signs of their psychological behaviors, apart from the, you know, the physical behaviors. They show psychosocial failures, you know. So definitely. And this is because they are so affected by, you know, engaging in sexual relationships with older men. And the reason they do this is one of the findings is that in it's a common thread of early relationships with absence of unreliable caregivers or parents, which influences their ability to form and maintain emotional bonds in adulthood. And it's also a lack of financial dependability that causes them to depend on older men for finances and for security.
And Nadia, you suggest that this phenomenon is being, in many ways, normalized by social media. I would probably add to that celebrity culture and music. But it's difficult to escape from that right now, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely difficult. Because, I mean, social media is on the rise. And so is poverty as well. Unemployment is a huge contributing factor to that. So in most cases, these young girls don't have any option. And obviously they are being lured by the older men who offer them finances in return.
You've correctly drawn links between an insecure childhood attachment and these adult relationships. And obviously the role of absent or neglectful parenting structures plays a huge role in this. But again, given the social paradigm, that is something which is going to be very difficult to change.
Yes, most definitely, because there isn't much education around, you know, especially like with early childhood, where schools and NGOs and government, I think government is failing in this area, where there isn't much education around this. And I think it's got to start off from a young age, and that would be school, where you educate and knowing that especially the ones that's coming from poorer society, they need to be educated, because then they would know this is the right or the wrong path that I'm taking.
So in that respect, then, obviously not enough is being done by government, and particularly a department like social development or even education, I imagine. Is it too late for intervention, or has the ship already sailed, do you think?
I don't think it's too late for intervention because, I mean, if you look at NPOs and NGOs and most definitely the National Shelter Movement of South Africa, we are actually doing the groundwork. And if we can do it, I'm sure that government or the private business sector can also partner in assisting. It's just that, like, if you look at the Rape Crisis Center, they often experience these underage young girls who engage in these transactional sex or living with pimps, and they are often reported to Department of Social Development, but they get no help at all. And these girls are young, and they, you know, they're already experiencing so much of financial difficulties at home. And eventually, even if the Rape Crisis Center or some of our NGOs help them, they still go back to that situation because there isn't any financial assistance at their home, which leads them right back to the same path.
So what type of intervention then would need to be fast-tracked by government to try and arrest this problem?
Well, there needs to be intensive psychotherapy interventions, you know, because these girls are they're already showing signs of distress, and they showing signs of depression, anxiety, even suicidal and psychosis as well, which obviously leads to substance abuse. So if not just government, but if schools and businesses and NGOs, if we can, you know, just counter this kind of education, you know, even starting from primary school level, because you even see, even at schools, the teachers are just, you know, they're so detached. And I guess it's also because of the behavior of these children. We know that, you know, this generation of kids are completely different to what we were when we were growing up. But it's obviously because of technology, and it's obviously because of the unemployment rate and the poverty. It all is in line with each other, and that's the behavior.
Thank you very much for joining me today. That is Nadia Monsami from the National Shelter Movement. I do appreciate your time. And that's where we're going to leave it. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We're here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday, or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.